Hello and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to the world's longest running football fans podcast from CelticUnderground.net. If you like what you hear today, you can subscribe at iTunes. And you can download or listen at a variety of places where I'm sure you can also subscribe. And these are SoundCloud, Audioboom, Spreaker and YouTube. And of course, the website, CelticUnderground.net. This week's podcast a wee bit different. 10 days or so ago, there was an evening in the Admiral Bar with three authors. Well, it was actually four authors. Miss Paul Cuddy was also there. But it was mainly a Q&A session and discussion with Paul Dykes, who wrote The Quality Street Gang, our own Stephen Murray with 10 Men Won the League, and Stephen Sullivan, author of Celtic's Iron Man, the biography of Sean Fallon. Last week after the IS game, we put out part A of podcast number 267 with audio from the evening, and, well, shockeroony, tonight is part B. So, enough from me. This is Harry Brady and all those gentlemen mentioned in the introduction. And this is part B of the Celtic History Night recorded at the Admiral Bar. Also, before I stick it on, please do not forget the Celtic FC Foundation bucket collection for the Christmas appeal takes place on Saturday. There may be some space for volunteers, but the main thing is, get your change ready for Saturday. There'll be people there at the turnstiles from when they open. This is me, Harry Brady, saying, I'll see you on the other side.
Plenty of questions from Moses. As I said at the start, there's some of you have taken advantage of buying the guys' books there and getting them signed. There'll be that opportunity at the end as well. And also, once we're finished, just to remind you that you can then go upstairs and enjoy a few drinks in the upstairs part of the Admiral as well and make a night of it if you want. So, obviously, very welcome to stay to closing time. So, as I said, what we're going to maybe do is in the second half is just open it up and if anybody's got any questions at all that they want to ask. What we'll maybe do is, we're kind of recording this as well, so if anybody asks a question, I'll maybe just repeat it just so we get the audio for it, and then whoever it's directed to, or all the guys can come in and answer. So, I mean, basically, if anybody's got any questions, just you can be the first one to ask a question in the call here.
Yeah, a quick question. It's just if any of the panel can pinpoint the reason for the what looks like a decline since one European Cup. If there's one reason they can pinpoint.
That's one reason, probably most of you have, but one reason that any of the panel can pinpoint for that post has been decline.
I mean, as I say, I really feel it was an unnecessary, maybe you can say a decline in terms of they didn't win a European Cup after 67. I would say that the decline didn't really come about until maybe 74 or something, you know. Like, I think that until that period, Celtic had the ability, the capacity, the squad to win another European Cup, you know, and I think it was only that after that the decline really set in. And as I say, Sean, as we spoke about earlier, Sean and Jock Stephen's view was very much that it was Bob Kelly's death. Maybe a couple of years before Davy Haig going, it was really the beginning of the end, or the beginning of the end of the great years. But yeah, it was from 74 onwards. That's when I think you could probably say that Celtic really were in decline. And maybe even I think the view in 74 was that although Atletico, you know, was an infamous game and they were dreadful and their behaviour was shocking, that Celtic were a bit of a diminished force even by then, that basically the Lisbon Lions would have beaten that Atletico team, dirty or not, you know. So I think it was maybe around that time that it started to go downhill, and it just seemed to be that was they were selling players, not replacing them. It was always Sean said, you know, that they would sell a player for 250,000, they'd give Jock 20,000 to replace him, you know, and you can't keep on doing it. And there seemed to be a kind of conviction in the board that, that because they kept on producing these players, because, you know, Sean kept on going out and signing the George Conleys and the Kendall Lucius, that they would always keep on doing that, so they could sell the Willie Wallace, they could sell, you know, the John Hughes, and there would always be a guy there to replace him. And they said, you can't just keep on doing that. You can't keep on selling great players and expecting year after year to be producing them. But there was this kind of complacency at Celtic that this conveyor belt would go on forever. And I think that that's they became victims of their own success a little bit. But I think, yeah, Jock and Sean was very much of the view that, that Jock Stephen Sean felt that it was Bob Kelly's death. And then I think Davy Hayes' sale was also a real key moment in that as well.
No, it's a fantastic question. I think I covered it slightly in the Goalish Shagan book, and it touches on one of the points that Stephen made in terms of the youth quality that's coming through. I mean, the first draft, I suppose, that I went back and spoke about was the Kelly kids, and then you had some of those and some of the younger guys who became the Lisbon Lions with a couple of acquisitions, and then you had another group, another wave of youngsters coming through with the Quality Street Gang. And I think that there was a dearth of talent after that. There was almost a lost generation of youngsters that weren't making the same kind of impact, and it took a few years before your Pat Bonners and Roy Aiken, Tony Burns, etc. started coming through again. So yeah, I would go with that. I would go with the fact that, you know, you could lose a player, but if you had somebody with the talent of a Danny McGrain or a Doug Leash to pull in from the reserve team, then you can almost take that blow. And they just didn't have that talent coming through. The conveyor belt, there was a whole generation missed out there just after the Quality Street kids.
If you're talking about the decline, it's not a bad decline if you still get to a final and two semi-finals. Mm-hmm. But you're right when you say it. There was probably, looking back now, there was signs that things weren't getting, things were maybe deteriorating. I think I can see the watershed being in 74 against Atletico Madrid, because we were that much away to get to another final. Mm-hmm. And I actually think we'd have a right good chance of beating Bayern Munich in the final. For the record, I don't think we'd have beat Ajax in 72 had Dixie scored a penalty. You know, the Cruyff and the Skins team, they're right up there with the best ever. And as much as I love Jockstein and love Celtic, and I've got faith in them, that would have been a tall order, because the Ajax had beat us fairly convincingly 12 months previously. But for me, the watershed 74, because up till 74, we're playing in the European Cup semi-final, but we're still producing great players. And yet, within a couple of seasons, we're getting beat by Olympiakos, Wisla Krakow, Innsbruck, Saxon Rings, Vicku, teams with great respect to them, that a few years earlier we would have beat fairly convincingly. So probably 74 is the watershed, and the two guys have touched it already, you know, like Hale even, and then George Conley's demise was a real big blow. And there was other things as well. Stevie Murray's injury, I think, was a bad one. He had played on for a few years. Brian McLaughlin was going to be the next big thing. He got the injury and it set him back. So really, if there's a reason, I think it's bad luck. Because if Dixie had scored a penalty, if Atletico would have played the game, we might have beat them in a fair fight, rather than getting dragged into a brawl. And then the things I'll talk about, Davy Hayes was self-inflicted, obviously, but you know, the Connollys and the Stevie Murrays, and you can only go at the well so many times.
Good question, then.
Just following on for that, I mean, when you talk about decline, I mean, it's almost sacrilegious to say it, but I think by the time they get round to playing Leeds at Hampden, which I was privileged to be there by that time because I was 12 and I went to every game, if anything, I think the team then were... The changes in the team, if anything, they gave it a harder core. To me, that was the pinnacle. Okay, they'd a bad day against Feyenoord, never win the cup, but I mean, I think if anything, and we don't like... I'm not criticising the Lisbon team, but if anything, the few changes have made them stronger, a stronger unit. And then off tack, but still in your same era, one that I still bang the drum about when I get a chance, was Harry Hood, our finest ever uncapped player, to the SFA's shame.
The two guys that jumped when I was a boy, certainly when he sailed at games, that didn't get caps, was Harry Hood and Tommy Callaghan. Mm-hmm. And there was a reason, I know Tommy was everybody's cup of tea, there was an element of the support to give him a hard time, because he was the attacker, and you know. You've got guys like Davy Hay and Murdoch running about hoffing guys in two, and Tommy never really get involved in that, but he was what you might call a thoroughbred footballer, but Hooden Callaghan didn't get caps, and that is, I suppose that's a source of regret to them as individuals. And Harry Hood was the Scottish top scorer in 1971. He was a great player for Celtic, Harry Hood, but that one season was his best. He scored the cup final, he scored the goal against Aberdeen, it got his league at Pittodrie, and he was entitled that season to at least to get to the Nationals. But back in the days that they played Ireland and Wales, he used to try out a few players before the big game against England. And I think Harry could definitely say he was really, really unlucky not to get a killer.
Question
down
in front of you.
Really just an observation more than a question. I touched on it in the first session about how the Lisbon Lions were eventually phased out and moved on, and the Quality Street gang came through, and Stephen touched on about Jock, for want of a better word, perhaps to kind of leash at the 74 World Cup as a future star in England. I think you don't realise how big a man and an influence Jock Stephen was at Celtic. I think we're actually been a wee bit naive when we don't think he ever had any influence over the board. And we're not here to besmirch Jockstein's memory, I'm sure many is up, but I think we'd really be naive if we don't believe that he had an influence on the board to say, here is the time to move these guys on, because I've got faith in the Lou McCarries, the Ken Reeves, the George Connollys. So I just think it's something that we should always consider. I think it's always kind of been embedded in my mind, moving on to a further point, my link to the Quality Street gang. Most of you here have probably seen Celtic through the early 80s, with Tommy Burns, Morgan McClouds, David Provins, Pat Warner, McGrain, Aiken, don't need to tell you the names, but if you can actually think of Celtic holding on to some of that Quality Street guy, Josh Connolly would only have been 36 in 1986, playing next to a young Paul McStay, or a Brian McLaughlin in there, or a Lou McCarry up front at the tail end of their career. I think if you watch Celtic in the early 80s, you're probably missing two or three stars from being a real top European side. Unfortunately, the positions we were missing in were key positions.
That's a really good point you make, and it's one of the things that came up in the first half. I was going to ask the guys on, you mentioned Bobby Murdoch leaving too early, and then you also mentioned the fact that Graham Souness had trained at Celtic, and Souness' side, the influence of Bobby Murdoch has been absolutely pivotal at Middlesbrough to his development as a player. That kind of goes back to what you were, fair enough point to make, Paul.
I think it's strange because I was doing a lot of research on Middlesbrough for the Neely Mockingbrook. Obviously he was down there for two seasons, and what I found pretty quickly was that Bobby Murdoch's an absolute legend at Middlesbrough, you know, and the way that they go on about Murdoch is incredible. So he had a few years left in him, certainly as a player. But when you look at the influence of Bobby Lennox, for example, who is one of the guys who did remain so influential to the youngsters coming through, I always look at the Celtic boot room, and something again I've touched on with the Neely book. We had a boot room, you know, as good as the Liverpool boot room in terms of players who had played alongside each other, and then they moved into the management side of the game, and it was really just to try and keep that progression. So a guy like Billy McNeil was the only man to take over. Bobby Lennox was still there. It would have been fantastic even just to have a face like your Bobby Murdoch. The influence of somebody like him would have been phenomenal, or Bertie Auld, you know, these types of players. But I take your point regarding Jock Stein and the fact that, you know, a lot of these decisions obviously were behind his back, or, you know, underhand moves that he could do nothing about himself.
Yeah, I mean, I would completely agree with that as well, and Sean was very much of that view. A lot of the decisions, and McCarry certainly, and a few that followed, were very much, Jockstein felt they were dispensable. And I mean, I could be wrong. I know, you know, Stephen was mentioning the first half there about John Fallon, John Fallon's book, which I read as well, about the Ken Douglas thing. I think there was always a feeling with Jockstein that he was, especially Pally with Shankly, we were talking about this with Shankly at Liverpool, and then that continued even after Shankly left. There was a closeness there, and that he was always, it was maybe more of a readiness to sell to Liverpool than anyone else, and maybe that's what John Fallon's alluding to. I'm not too sure, but you can let me know when you speak to him. But yeah, there was certainly, I know that Sean said he was absolutely raging when Lou McCarry went to Man United rather than Liverpool, because he'd let it all sewn up personally in a kind of handshake with people down there. So that could be a factor. And in terms of the, you know, talking about the Feyenoord, and you're saying about Leeds United maybe being the pinnacle, I know Sean's view was very much that he said he felt the Jocks team really felt this as well, that the final thing was just a mistake in the team they picked, you know, that really that George Conley had been in for the semi-final, the shape had worked, you know, even a 4-3-3, and then they changed it back and George Conley went back to the bench for the final, and they said that was the key decision, rather than, because you speak to the players around that time, they're totally split. A lot of people say that Jocks team underestimated Feyenoord. Like Darry McGrain can completely deny that. They say that he didn't, you know, it was the build up was really intense and he was playing up their strengths. So it was a real bit of a split there. But the one thing that they seemed to all agree on was that the wrong team was picked and the wrong shape was picked. And that was what Sean said, that the Jocks team really did kind of, I think there was a regret later, it was that he didn't pick George Conley, he didn't pick the same team that had gone out against Leeds.
Next question. Here we go. Yeah.
Hi there. First thing I want to say, it's just basically, it's not so much a question, it's an observation. And we discussed earlier on in the first session, Ken Dalglish leaving for 440,000. But if you remember in 77, no sooner had Dalglish joined Liverpool when Keegan had moved on to Hamburg. Mm. And 2 years after that, the £1 million transfer comes in with Trevor Francis. So money was a boom, boom, boom scenario at that time. And even some teams, some players for Celtic are saying, let's get my last wage check, I'm out of here. As much as I hate to say that. But not yourself, sir. You mentioned George Conley, one of the best players, and I put it down to one of the best players. I even spoke to Dan McGrain and I says, Danny, who's your best ever player? He owned it by Pin, Celtic Bay, just up the road at Parkhead Cross. He says, my best player is Ken Dalglish. I says, Danny, mentions always going with George Conley. He says, I wouldn't argue with you, but he never served out his time. And yourself, Stephen, you touched on the fact that Sean Conley, Sean Fallon, being the manager during the 75 period and what have you moved up, and we could have went for 10, but I strongly believe Rangers brought EBTs at that time.
Regarding the Lucy's transfer fee, that's a funny one, because even as a boy, I think if anybody remembers the Lucy when he left, 440, that's a good number, you know what I mean? It's, why not end up with 450, you know, why not 500?
That was our time.
Why 440? There was a boy a few years ago brought a book out, it was a biography of Lucy, a guy called Stephen Kelly, who's a big noise down in Liverpool, and he's done major books about Shankly and Paisley. And he's telling the story from the Liverpool perspective. Paisley turned up at Celtic Park with the Liverpool chairman, and they were fully. They just got £500,000 for Kevin Keegan. Kevin Keegan went to Hamburg for £500,000, which was the biggest transfer record fee of any British player. Right, so that was the level, if you like, to aim for. And he said we were fully prepared to go the whole hog for Dalglish, and we couldn't believe it. Desmond White at the beginning wanted to sell for £300,000, right? And Steen got a hold of Desmond White and he says, no, we need to be negotiating here. So he kept getting up blocks of 20, 340, and so they got to 440. And apparently, according to the reason to think these guys are telling the truth, because the side witness account for the time for the Liverpool perspective. And really what happened was, it got to 440, and apparently White got a bit, for whatever reason, he said, no, that's enough. There's no more negotiations, we're taking 440. At which point Jock Steen got up and left the room because he knew that Liverpool were wanting to go 500. Now 60,000 these days doesn't sound like a lot of money. 60,000 in 1977 was a huge amount of money. You know, it kind of got you a top quality Scottish player in the SPL. So that's the reason why it was 440, because White basically bottled it. I don't know what White was fighting over if Liverpool would pull the plug. if Liverpool would have been snug. They just sold the lease for 500. In their own words, they get a better player and they get £60,000 profit.
Do you mind make a comment on that? I've worked in the brewing industry. There's a real quite close cross between all the beer cans and bottles of beer. You know, 125, 175, a 330, a 440, a 500, a 600. And there's a lot of people believe there's a cross between that. 445. Same thing. It's a coincidence.
Question reaching at the very back.
No comment.
First of all, I think you just woke up by dropping a bit of slack. And I'm sure as well. What happened with the players when they went in the left? I don't know what they did. You can't blame dropping for 1970. I mean, Darren Williams was in goal, the big brother lost it. And even after that, when you're talking about the right and wrong with a flipper, when you're telling the supporters, we're all here because we're all Celtic supporters. Men and women, we're all here for one thing. But don't tell me, I was three rows behind Big Job screen and let it go my hood when we get put out when they kicked. When they actually destroyed Jimmy Johnson. But don't tell me then, and look at UEFA and FIFA now, that wasn't corrupt. And don't tell me in the Bernabeu with 3,500 Celtic fans, and I was one of them, I went to the Cope Bridge, because amongst 127,000 Spanish, that wasn't corrupt when they caught Peter Maxwell with the ball. So I think we should just cut Big Job and Sean Farrell and leave up to Spain.
You make a good point there, actually, about Billy McNeil and Feyenoord. And you know, I remember as a wee boy, growing up in the early 70s, and you would read football books and about Celtic, and they would tell you about Lisbon and how they beat Leeds in front of the record crowd and how they get their nine in a row. And then I remember seeing this thing of Feyenoord European Cup final, Celtic beat Feyenoord. I'm saying, my dad, you never missed that one. It was almost like the way I describe it is it was like a family secret. You know, some sort of shining thing that happened that nobody wanted to talk about. We're talking about the wedding and all that, and all the good stuff, but you don't like to talk about that, you know. Keep that under the table. Now, I actually remember as well, in the advent of video, that it was the Celtic centenary season. The club brought out a great video at the time. It's the Celtic history, obviously, I think we've all seen it. Yeah. And I remember watching it, and that was the first time I'd ever seen the final goals. And see, when I saw the second goal, honest to God, you know, I thought to my dad about that, you're kidding me on. A European Cup final with 2 minutes to go and to get to a replay. And that happened. You know what I mean? The total lack of concentration, the ball coming through. I don't know what Billy was doing. You know what I mean? And he's a legend, and I would never say a bad word against him, but, you know, on that night, it was total aberration.
Shocking, man.
But they nearly got away, but that's the thing. And I think Stephen touched it earlier, that if we could have got a replay, I don't think we could have played much worse, and it would have been interesting to see how history would have panned out if we had got the second European Cup final, because now you're building a wee empire, you get two. Rather, it's great to win one, but if you win two, that doubles your prestige. So
my whole point is,
no, I mean, I spoke to you, I mean, I spoke to you the break as well. I mean, I completely agree with you that in terms of explaining away the final thing, it was always the point that was made that the allegation that he underestimated them. And what I was saying in terms of Sean explaining, and I know you've read the book because I spoke to you the break, that he wasn't criticising, he was saying he noticed that because it was one of the few things that he was saying that Jobson himself felt that he'd maybe picked the wrong team. And that can happen, I mean, that's a mistake, rather than maybe underestimating them, which is maybe.
No,
you know,
I'm sitting up for Sean. For
yeah, absolutely, yeah.
I think it's
yeah,
easy to blame there for Evan Gordon's mistake or somebody else's mistake.
And that's what I mean. I know that's what a few of the players as well feel at the time. They just a good number of players just didn't show up that night. You know, it wasn't, you know, some of the players who were fantastic, you know, 3 years earlier, that night just had an off night, and there was too many of them. So, you know, that can happen.
Yeah, another question. Another question from the front here.
Stephen, talking about the 78-79 season, obviously know all about. Obviously down the break. To me, that season, the rank said probably one of the lowest points total to win a league. And I know you're saying, I actually thought Celtic that season were very, very indifferent that season, very poor in a lot of games. That was the Burnleys, we beat the Rangers a couple of weeks before it. The fans never even bought into the team that year either. I remember maybe the week before it they'd maybe 14,000 against Hearts in the Monday night game. The week of 4-2 again, going to the league
7 days before,
and I think we had more at Ibrox against
the London game,
well, the fans never just bought into the team. But the one good thing, I think you'd agree with, the two buys that year were absolute fabulous buys, two young Scottish players. A 20-year-old Murdoch McLeod for 100 grand and 120 was it for Gary Proven, 22-year-old. Now I would like to see, like, the current team maybe take a wee chance to say, like, let's go with a bit of youth here, whether it's through the youth development or whether it's through buying, like, good young Scottish players, you know, as well. Because that night, the 4-2 game as well, you had Mike Conroy in the middle of the park. Mike Conroy hardly ever gets up. To me, Mike Conroy done a good job at Celtic, and he was a good player. Billy McNeil said a good player for him. Mike Conroy must have only got 19-20 that night.
Aye, aye.
Where did he come from? Junior club? Johnstonborough?
Yeah, Port Glasgow.
Port Glasgow, was it? Yeah, Roy Aiken. Was Roy Aiken 20 year old that night? Was he 20? No.
Murdo
McClory 20.
That's
right. George McCluskey 21.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very, very young team against a team. I think Rangers were like quarter finals European Cup that year.
You're right, and
as well.
See the thing about them being boys. The ones that I spoke to, excuse me, spoke to Davey and Mick Conroy in length, and they said if he'd have been their experience, we might not win that game. We were totally naive.
Mm-hmm.
I made a point earlier on there about it was almost like schoolboy football because they were chasing the ball and their enthusiasm carrying them through. But Davey Provan and Murdo McCloy, it couldn't happen without them because they were great signings. Now, Davey Provan, I remember being in, I was in the first year at school in St Gerald's, and my PE teacher was a guy called Jackie McGilvery,
mm-hmm.
who played with Davey at Kilmarnock. And I remember the next day, like, they didn't know much about Provan because he didn't get the same coverage in the days that you get now, you know, with TV and that kind of thing. So we knew we'd made a big signing and we were quite happy. And I remember going into school and Jackie McGilvery taught us as boys, he says, that is the best signing you could have made. He will be a star at Celtic. He says, that guy's fantastic. And he wasn't far off it. And the Murdo McLeod one's funny because I found that quote at the time for Billy McNeil. Billy McNeil went to, you know, you don't just sign a guy out the blue, you watch him maybe half a dozen, maybe even a dozen times. And all the reports that come back is that Murdo being a great player. And Billy went down to watch him, and he says, I always remember, he says, there was two guys I was watching, Murdo in midfield and Graham Sharp up front. And Big Billy, his regret was, he said, the Bart can't have two good players. You know what I mean? He says, they might have won, but I don't think we can go with two. And you know, Graham Sharp had a wonderful career with Everton, and he could easily join us and did something else, but it's a funny thing.
Any more questions? I was going to ask Paul, you in the first half you touched upon the tour that your team went to in Italy. And that always comes a moment in the development of that team, and it is an incredible picture you see on the back. And how important was it then for them to go there and come back as a team?
It was my ambition when I started writing the book to track down the guys in that picture, and that was my starting point here. That was the first new place that Celtic had this special group of boys, and Casale won for that one in Northern Italy. I've been invited to this wedding next year in Italy, and I say to my wife, where is it? Because I want to go and visit, you know, that's how I'm obsessed with it. But every single player that I spoke to, Danny that even remembers it, they went up to a tailor's in Glasgow and they were going up to get the blazers, you know, the green blazers with the embroidered Celtic crest, and they all got measured up. And every one of them spoke so fondly of that moment. Lou McCarrie says in his autobiography that he doesn't keep memorabilia, gives it away jersey, he says, but never ever give away that blazer. But no, that's how important it was. It was their first experience, I suppose. A lot of them had never left the country. A lot of them, you know, it was the first time they'd been in an aeroplane. And it was their first experience as being a Celtic representative in Europe as well. So it was all so well planned. You know, Steen knew exactly what he was doing with that, and he was giving them an insight into what it was, what it meant to be a Celtic representative, and what it meant to actually go and represent that club elsewhere. I mean, there was a bit of hijinks over in Italy as well, which is in the book, but that particular tournament, I think, was pivotal in their development. And just while I remember, actually, a wee story about Danny McGrain. McGrain, if you look through the history books, didn't come in as a 17-year-old into the Celtic first team. He was one of the kind of last Cottle Street kids to make his debut in the first team. And there was a guy called John Taggart who signed for Celtic on the same day as Lou McCarrie. And John told the story that there was a game at Broomfield, it was a reserve game. And Danny would have been in his 20s by this point. And John spoke to him outside after the game and he says, aye, how's it going, Danny? He says, I'll tell you, if I didn't get a first team game soon, I'm off, I'm quitting. And again, when you think about that, because his development was a wee bit later than, you know, Brian McLaughlin, who made his debut when he was 16 years of age. But George came in very, very young. Dalglish came in young, then went back into reserves. But McGrain, it took a wee while for him to establish himself. And it's almost unthinkable that, you know, he would have kicked his heels and went away somewhere else. Unbelievable. But that's the twist of fate, and that's the difference between a Kenny Dalglish and another player who a lot of us probably haven't heard of, you know. Anyway,
Any more questions? Well, I'll take one up the back here.
Just talking about your teams here and reserves, do you think the players these days, the youths, are missing reserve football?
Oh, definitely. If I could come in here first. I did a podcast recently with Andy Ritchie, who was an absolute joy to talk to. Andy's a real character, and he's another guy, absolutely, and he's another guy that's got big regrets because he could have been a real. Paul's touched on all these other guys, maybe the one that he missed out, maybe for that era in the early to mid 70s. Few Celtic players had the talent available that had Andy Ritchie. And he was lamenting the fact that he said, remember Jock's coming in one day and Jock Stein says, you better come in early tomorrow, you're playing at Parkhead in the reserves. And he said, this was his first reserve game. And he played youth football and he played in junior football. He said, but he said, nothing can prepare you for playing against professionals, seasoned professionals. And he says, I think we're playing against Dundee. And reserve teams in the days would have been a mixture of young boys and a mixture of guys that were playing in the first teams. And he said, I'll never forget it. He said, there was number 8, and I sat in the dressing room, and Jinky was number 7, because Jinky was coming back for injury. And he said, I couldn't believe it. I was going to be in a pitch with Jimmy Johnson. And he says, Jimmy talked to him all the way through it, when they were getting changed. He talked to him out in the park, and he talked to him after the game. And he says, I learned there 90 minutes with Jimmy Johnson than I ever had coached with any coach in my whole life. He said, because on the park, he told me what to do, where to go, when to release it, when to order. And he said, I just began to pick things up, and it began to make sense somehow, that on the pitch, he said, but when you're playing with these guys, and he said, with other guys as well, he was talking earlier about Callan and Hood. He said, they were great guys as well. They're not remembered as Celtic greats. He said, but they were great professionals. And the wonderful thing about that generation was, and I've read and heard wee bits of Tommy Byrne speak about this as well, is the experienced players were so keen to pass their experience on to the boys. There wasn't any sort of jealousy that somebody was going to take your place. It was the fact that they'd seen it as their duty to pass on their experience and their knowledge to the next wave that were coming through to try and ensure Celtic continue to be successful. So Andy says that these days, if you play under 13 football, partly when you get to under 18, under 19, you've been playing against the same boys for 6 seasons. They're sick of playing against each other. He says, but in reserve football, the difference was you got to play with real men, experienced professionals. And his opinion is that we've lost a lot through losing reserve football.
You guys want to lose at all?
No, I think it's an excellent point because I've been lucky enough to interview a lot of the ex-players who sampled reserve football from the 60s right up to the 1980s, and to a man, every single one of them echoes their point. Mick Jackson was speaking about it, and he's a scout. He's been a scout for years. He's a scout for Spurs, I think, at the minute. And you know, he says when he goes down south, and he can see the disparity between the youths up here. I mean, Graham Morrison, a player who had to retire kind of young in the early 90s or the mid 90s with Celtic, he described it to me as going up a hill and having to stop. He says, I'm trying to get started. After the 18 years, your development stops you, and it's so hard to actually make that next step up to the first team, and then you're out of your depth. So I think there's a wee bit of a period there, and it's been mentioned recently in the last couple of weeks, I think, with Strachan coming out with his manifesto, and they are talking about the reserves. I remember at the time, a lot of the kind of provincial clubs were wondering about the cost at the time. And it's probably going to be quite difficult to set it back up again, to be fair. But for the good of the game, I think it'd be a great thing.
I was just going to say there that Jimenez used to buy an Evening Times on a Saturday night, and you only bought it for one thing, you see the reserves score. Because when you play Rangers at Parkhead, the reserves play the Ibrox. So you run out to the shop to get a wee tiny couple of paragraphs there that told you Charlie Nicholas had scored the hat trick at Ibrox, and you're thinking, you must be some player. Right, and that's the first inclination that you get, and then you bought yourself to Gura Wednesday, maybe a wee report about the reserve on the back page. Not a great deal, but enough to maybe get an indication of who was breaking through, like Paul McStay, who's going to be the next big thing. The two I certainly remember is Nicholas and McStay, who you knew instinctively were going to be big players just through the reviews that they were getting in the Celtic due to that thing.
You know, as well, even at the time of the review, I think reserve football had diminished by the time I was reviewed in terms of its importance and its intensity, the way it used to be played. But you still had guys in there you would still have, say, Sean Maloney playing on a team maybe that had, you know, Juninho in there, some, you know, someone that we could learn off. And I think you look at some broken anyway, because you look at maybe Forrest has come through Kieran Tierney lately, but there's something not right, because even that team that wasn't, it's not the Celtic's youth, you know, system that's most prolific, but you had the Maloney's coming through, the David Marshalls, the, you know, guys like Ross Wallace have gone on to good careers, you know, you need at least a decent little supply, and it seems that since then they need to take another look at it, because it's and Celtic aren't alone in that, to be fair, it's only maybe the United that's got a youth system, and maybe that's because these guys just get chucked straight into the first team and they're getting the kind of season throws that way. But it's yeah, something's not working anyway, so whether it's reserve football or something else, you need to take a look at it.
Okay, questions? A couple of others. Hand up the arms.
If you look at Scottish football just now, look at how many ex-Celtic players that are working throughout Scottish football just didn't take that step to the Celtic. Any of the panel that are commenting that about the amount of players that's living through Scottish football?
Start from the far right and work away a lot.
I think when you look at the setup at Celtic Park, if you've ever been lucky enough to go up to Lennox Lane, I mean, the facilities are absolutely outrageous. But every single club, every single year, and England's exactly the same, the amount of free transfers, young lads, you know, who have no first-time experience and they get a free transfer and, you know, all their hopes and dreams are gone. And I think linking that back into my story, that damaged some of the guys for the rest of their life. that rejection at the age of 18, you know, they've been hyped up and hyped up and it didn't work out for them. But you're absolutely right, you look at all these teams in the lower kind of divisions and they'll neither be ex-Celtic youth players. And again, there's a period of development which I think we're missing them. They guys could have been completely different, but you need to develop in a kind of man's world, if you like. And again, Stuart Balmer, there's a name that you might think, he was a big Celtic man, but what a career he had doing in Charlton. And his laddie plays now, Peter Gratz, the same, his lad plays. And I spoke today to guys in the last couple of months, and they are of the opinion that the reserve league really, really toughened them up. I mean, Balmer was saying, you know, he was playing alongside somebody like Tam McAdam, and he said, you know, I was learning things after that guy. Going back to what Stephen said, that you couldn't teach somebody from a textbook or even on a training pitch. You had to just get in there and, you know, learn pragmatically. And that's the biggest issue for me. But Celtic, I don't know how much it costs for the youth development. It's a phenomenal setup they've got, but the proof is obviously in the amount of players coming through. And again, it's really the traditions and the heritage of Celtic Football Club to rear our own. So again, I think that's at the heart of it for me as well.
I mean, it maybe goes back as well to the point where, you know, I mean, make mention earlier on about the Provins and the clouds, you know, and the importance. I get the impression that there's been a bit of a change of thinking at Celtic recently, you know, that they've kind of realised that for every Victor Wanyama, maybe there's three or four Amido Baldis and these kind of things. And so they're maybe going back to being a bit safer, trying to bring through the Tierneys, and when they're spending £1 million, they're going to spend it up at the United, sometimes it's success, sometimes not. But they're looking at the Scottish market and looking at players where they've got a fair idea they'll succeed, rather than trying to go down the route of finding a little gem. I mean, they'll still do it now and again with some individuals, but it seemed for a while that was all they were looking at, was the, you know, the Banguras and the Valdis and things. And I do get the impression that whether it's coming from Peter Law or whether it's coming from you know, the manager, it does seem to be a little bit of a change of philosophy at the moment, whether that benefits us in the long term, no one knows, but you'd like to think so, and you'd like to see, you know, some more players coming through the system.
That's an interesting one, to why, you know, they go to other clubs, they do reasonably well, and yet they can't seem to do it here. But I think what frustrates me is, there's a Dundee United fan in Mallock, and when we went after Stuart Armstrong, I asked him, did you rate him, and he went, oh, a great player. And I said, it's a funny thing, because we're winning that youth league every year, so to my mind, whoever played for Celtic in Stuart Armstrong's position was a better player, arguably, than Stuart Armstrong. But I don't know who it is, because he hasn't broke through. So, if you're winning league titles and you're winning youth cups, you're entitled to think that your youth policy is going in the right direction, because these guys seem to be the best of that age group, the best collective group that there is. And yet, for some reason, as individuals, they can't even seem to make that jump between the youth football and the first team, which is probably going on the circles a wee bit here, because I think reserve football would help them. It would help them just make that wee jump to A to B, because it is very, very difficult for young boys, as Stephen described there, the guy that said that it's like you're up a hill and you can't get any further. So we have to try something different, but it's good to see ex-Celtic players go away and do well. You want them to do well, but will we ever see the days that you maybe get 7 or 8 Celtic youth players breaking through to make up the majority of the team? Then I'm not sure that would happen, sadly to say.
Can I just add to that point? I haven't played amateur football or all of my days, but most of my days. My third out, when you were a teenager and you were in a decent team and you had the older players, they were absolutely delighted to impart their wisdom and their ability to you and for you to learn from that. And clearly that's something that's been lost with the reserve football no longer being the case. I'm sure that Stephen Sullivan is a bit of a veteran himself now, his amateur football. Not only did I look up to him as a fantastic journalist, but a half decent life back, and he probably learned so much from him. So it's definitely something that we missed.
I was going to just ask on the back of that to the guys that Scott Brown has started doing some coaching with the under 20s and taking training and taking pre-match stuff. Obviously, guys have touched on the whole the competition, who they're playing, but do you think that idea of somebody that experience helping and giving his time to actually do that will have a benefit?
I mean, I think it maybe goes back to something we talked about earlier as well, and it's directly related to that, but one of the big things that all the College Street gang talk about is the benefit they had from the training sessions with the Lions, and maybe that was something that the generation that came after that lacked, was they didn't have that kind of the team there ready to impart their wisdom, ready to test themselves again, because by the time the next generation were coming through, a lot of the College Street gang had been sold or had been injured or whatever, and I think that would seem to be a huge thing in development, the Dalglishes and the McGreans and these things, if they were up against Jimmy Johnson training, up against Bobby Murdoch, you know, they had, you know, the guys that were passing on little bits of tidbits of advice and knowledge. And maybe that's missing as well these days. You know, I know that they're trying to bring that back about getting the young players into training, the first team training. But by all accounts, those training sessions for the making of that team, you know, obviously they had the natural ability. But the fact they were mixing with the Lions and the Lions be the College Street gang, those games, they said sometimes were the toughest games the Lions played. And, you know, and I think the College Street gang said that Sean Fallon was the ref, they had a chance of winning, you know. So I think that's maybe a key thing. If you can have the likes of the Scott Browns coming in, teach the youth it, and then the ones that are showing any potential, get them up training with the first team straight away as much as they can, you know, and get a bit of competition and intensity. I mean, everyone they get in their minds when they see, you know, the Chief Cheese Aguirre thing, because, you know, I think most of the pros that you speak to say that's a good thing. If you're playing, if you're training that kind of intensity, you know, that can only be a positive thing. And speaking to any of the guys that were involved during the late 60s, early 70s, they said that was such a massive thing. And both sides loved it, the Lions loved it, because they were getting challenged. Every one of them was on their toes because they saw that there was a really talented youngster in their position, ready to step up, so they need to keep their level very high.
I think there's a wee bit to be said, just there's some mileage on what you're talking about the reserves, but I'm a great believer that the cream always floats to the top. And Charlie Nicholas and Paul McStay, for instance, they were going to Curragh where they were playing pro youth. And they were going to go to the very top. I think we got a wee bit lost in how we educate players and bring them through. The talent's got to be there. First and foremost, a Celtic fan, I want the very, very best in at Celtic Park. First and foremost, there is mileage in the reserve thing, but I don't think it's the be-all and end-all. It's identifying the proper talent at the first and then nurturing it to get into a first team player. It doesn't necessarily need to be by reserve football.
I was going to say that Andy Ritchie, Andy Ritchie was the idol. I'm a Morton fan. So Andy Ritchie is the best thing that ever happened to Morton. And Jockstein reckoned he was the best dead ball player he'd ever seen. He was a legend. Another big legend for Morton was the local general. I think you're finding that Celtic give other teams great quality players you never seen before. Particularly Andy Ritchie, Idle Idle.
It is concerning that the youth teams perform so well at national level, and yet year after year we see them parading a trophy around Parkhead and they're all defeated. It really is disappointing, but if I can perhaps show my age, I can recall going to a junior football match down in Stevenston in Ayrshire. It's a Scottish Cup match, The two teams playing were Aberdeen Recreation and Kirkintilloch Rob Roy. And on that day, Bobby Lennox was playing for Aberdeen and Jim Forrest was playing for Kirkintilloch. And it just surprises me that Celtic don't identify perhaps a section of the players that they're going to free and perhaps even farm them out to junior clubs.
You're definitely touching something there as well, because first of all, can I just say Scott Brown's coaching the boys, hope he's not coaching them out of class. So that's a bit of a worry for a start. But regarding junior football, like that, I spoke to Danny again, and Danny says he went to Maryhill. Apparently, the season he was at Maryhill, I'm sure he said this, did they finish bottom of the junior league, of whatever junior league they were in? But Danny says, I still picked up experience. And Danny McGrain, probably pound for pound, is the best, cleanest tackler I ever saw. Danny was a clumsy guy. Danny went in there and won it clean. Slight tackling, he was impeccable. When he had a winger running against him, if he went head to head, he won the ball and he always won it in a clean fashion. And he claims that his tackling, of his quality of tackling, was honed playing in Maryhill, because these juniors again were passing on experience, and it was, he says it was a hard game. He says to be honest, it was the enjoyable sometimes. It used to be all out war, because you know the juniors are like, there's no a great subtlety or creative coach. It's guys in there, like, you know, going hammer and tongs against each other, no quarter asked, no quarter given. But you make a good point there, and Danny would back you up with that and say that the and I think they all went out to, and Kenny went out to Cumbernauld, and Josh Connolly went to Tully Allen, I think, to play for a very short period. But again, it toughened them up and taught them how to be men on the football pitch.
I mean, just to add to that, sorry, I just going to say as well, that in terms of the point you made about cream rising to the top, you know, I mean, I would totally agree with that. And I think as well that I was reading an article recently that kind of Celtic made a mistake with Jackson Irvine. You know, and I think it's all very well playing four or five good games for Ross County. You know, I just think it's a completely different thing. And when you go out and there's less pressure, I think some players can kind of, maybe, you know, Andy Ritchie always had all the natural talent in the world. I know that Sean, when he can assess these guys, they weren't, you know, he admired Kenny Dalglish because he said Kenny maybe didn't start off, and Jock Stephen and Bill Arkout didn't rate Kenny the highest at the start. He said he dedicated himself completely, and Sean, having not been a great natural talent himself, was very much the opinion that the guys that had the natural talent and didn't make the most of it, he had no time for. You know, like, and he said the guys like Kenny who worked on it and improved and, you know, worked away, they were the guys he really admired. And he said there's so many reasons why you don't make it a Celtic. You know, it takes all the things together, you know, the mentality, the ability, you know, the application. And he's only a few players have got that. And I mean, I used to go to the youth games when I was at the U all the time, and I was further the cause of some young player. I think he was a real talent, and I remember Martin O'Neill kind of slapping me down a couple of occasions and saying that, you know, you got it right. And he said see if these boys want anything more. He said, because I think there's only one I've got wrong. And he said the only one I've gone and had a decent, because it was Hitzlsperger, which he took as a kind of trialist in his first pre-season. And he said the rest of them I've let go, I've not done. He says, so just have a bit of trust in what I'm doing.
I'll take maybe just a couple of questions before we're kind of getting almost into injury time, so I'll take one here then and yourself there. So,
I'm just going to say, it's fascinating listening to you guys' insights and a great period in Celtic history, but just to bring it up today, I think whoever's writing the history, the current period in Celtic history, we've been thinking, well, it's going to be a chapter on EBTs and how that's affected the fact that Celtic have been up against a stacked deck for the last decade. I'd love to hear what you guys think about that and how you think the club should be taking a line on that. I think right now, my view would be maybe not quite as strong as it should be, but what do you think about that?
Well, I get a good question. the thing about EBTs is that, and we need to be careful here, is I was very confident even when Rangers were winning that justice would be done in the end and the EBTs would be seen to be illegal. And it would be very interesting to see the next step. I'm not an expert in this field, I have to say, if somebody wants to correct me, but I think the ball's in BDO's court because they're the liquidators. And they need to decide if they're going to appeal against the latest decision. Because you hear some guys in the radio playing, they say, Rangers are winning 2-1, you're like, no. That's a ludicrous... I don't think BDO will appeal, because I think their interest is to the creditors, and if they go to court's an expensive thing, and there's no much in the pot for the creditors, it'll even less if they go to court and they lose. So my inkling tends to be that this will be the end. That by the 2nd of December, I think, is the deadline. BDO won't appeal, and therefore Rangers will be seen to be illegal. Jeez. But until then, I don't think that anybody can say a great deal. Apart from everybody's got an opinion, but officially, and I think the club are playing it right, they're playing it cool, and I think it'd be a statement to the effect that, you know, we thought, as I said there, that even when the judgments were made, that they were the wrong judgments, and now, thankfully, somebody's come out with a correct judgment. So what happens then on remains to be seen, but it's to be hoped, possibly, that as happened with the Rangers thing in 2012, it has to be a collective. It can't be Celtic taking a take on themselves. And I know where I work, with St Mirren fans, Motherwell fans, they're a fair cross section, and they are raging as well. You know what I mean? So I think if there's a collective will amongst the clubs to do something, then we're living in interesting times here. Maybe not on the park, but certainly off the park.
I mean, I was listening to some Radio Scotland the other night, and Paul Lambert on, maybe somebody heard it, and I thought he completely missed the point. Like, I mean, he was saying, you know, that he's one on the park, you know, they won it. And I just think, how can you say there wasn't a sporting advantage? I mean, he was saying, you know, it's the two teams in the park, but there's no, because, okay, it was two teams in the park, but would they have had the De Boer brothers? Would they have had, you know, ever some of these players? That's the thing. I mean, I just don't see how you can possibly argue there wasn't a sporting advantage if they were able to pay more than they otherwise would be able to pay. I think it's crystal clear. The only thing is, I don't really know, in terms of your question, what more Celtic could do at this stage. I don't really have a problem with Celtic's behaviour, I don't know.
Maybe not at this stage. I think we've seen saying that once the stage finalised, they can't appeal. I think the club needs to make a strong statement saying these titles need to be issued an answer against in the rest of the record books, because it's disgusting. I think if they don't do that, I think they're going to upset a lot of fans. Myself, certainly, I'll be quite disappointed if they don't do that, but we just have to wait and see how it goes. So I think you're right. I think we have to wait until that's it, the decision's made.
EBTs
are wrong.
You
just
want
the
evangelist
there.
Paul, do you want to add anything at all?
I just agree with Stephen.
More of a George Moore, aren't
I? Well, that's what we're going to say. One more question.
Touching on the Scott Brown theme a wee bit earlier. He's obviously away, he's got a book coming in the next couple of days, and just how the writers feel that you have wrote stories about true legends and magical events in Celtic's history when the fans may be getting fleeced by a guy who splits opinion, but is by no means a Celtic legend, but has been endorsed by the club to sell a book for half a story when you guys have actually got a real story to tell.
I think what I would say is something that I've come to the conclusion over the last few years, actually, because of it's probably the reason I'm writing about 1950s, 60s and 70s, is because there are no legends in the modern game, in my opinion. Who are they going to be speaking about in 10, 15, 20 years? Who would I want to write about in 10, 15, 20 years? Nobody. Those days are gone, I believe. That's not a slight on Scott Brown, incidentally, fellow Fifer. But I just think we've changed so much now. You know, it's actually interesting that he's been there for, I think, 8 years now, because that's unheard of as well. But the days of legends are gone. I mean, it's going to be difficult 10 or 15 years for me to write a book in the modern era, unless it's about EBTs, you know.
Good, keep that going.
Yeah, I mean, without saying anything about Scott Brown, because I know Mark Emerson wrote it to me, and he's a great guy, and I know that he said that Scott was really open with him, so I'm not ready yet, but it might well be a good read. But I think that there's no doubt that the stories, you know, from the guys who've had the kind of lives that, you know, Malkins had, Sean Farns had, and had the kind of contributions, the stories are just used so rich, you know, like, and I think that's the, because initially when we were chatting about, you know, I didn't really thought about doing a book before, and we were chatting about more, and I said that it had to be Sean, it had to be, you know, something like, you know, a story like that, where he's got stories to tell, you know, real insights to impart, and things that make, you know, that you look back and you'll think, well, I didn't know that, I didn't know that, I didn't know that, and that's something about that I always wanted to know. Whether that's offered by, I know, like, whatever, Stephen Gerrard had about 7 books out, and like, all that, you know, like, you know, which is what Wayne Rooney had a book out when he was 17 or something, you know, like, so you're going to get that these days, and a lot of them, and it's just, I suppose it's difficult for the fan to sort through what, you know, sort of the wheat and the chaff, and know what, you know, you get about, you know, 83 books to what's the one you're going to pick. But I think hopefully, I think it's been the last few years, I think there have been a lot of good Celtic books, you know, a lot of good stories that haven't been told before, and things that, you know, and Lice of Pat's always produced, you know, great Celtic books. And I think as a club, I think there's not a bad body of literature out there, and hopefully there's still some more good stories to come, hopefully. I kind of agree with Paul, but I hope that he's wrong in a sense that there will be Sean Fallon down the line, there will be guys like that, because we're going to get all the poorer for it at the club if it's not the case.
It's I've already had a wee dig at Scott Brown there, but I'll leave it up by saying that if you're a captain of Celtic and a captain of Scotland and you've had a relative amount of success, that there's going to be a certain appeal to write a book, and he's going to differ probably with Roy Aitken or Tommy Burns doing it maybe 30 years ago or whatever. My only problem would be Scott Brown's book. He's maybe a wee bit too young. He's got a few years left in the engine yet. He'll certainly, I think, be with us for at least another couple of seasons, and then he's still a young man enough to go and maybe somewhere else and do something else. But as I said, my only criticism would be it's still a wee bit early, and the thing I would say is can't even give us some Pedro of a book. That was the
first ever. Okay, which guys? Just you mentioned Papley, it's obviously a historian, author. There's also another Celtic author, Brendan Sweeney, who's in here tonight, who's just published a book called Celtic, The Early Years. If you want to know what happened in those first 5 years of Celtic's existence, from 1887 to 1892, then Brendan's book has it. It's an extraordinary level of detail. So, as Stephen said, it just adds to the whole canon of Celtic books. I'm afraid I'm going to have to draw it to a close. We could probably go on all night. It's been fascinating listening to these three guys. Again, just want to thank the Admiral Bar for letting us have this event in here. And say, if you want to just go upstairs once we're finished up and enjoy the rest of the night here, you're very welcome. Obviously, as I mentioned at the start, your contribution by coming here tonight is helping Celtic FC Foundation's Christmas Appeal, which is goes back to the very ethos and roots of our club. Foundation are helping people, some of the most vulnerable in our society at this particular time of the year, so thanks for that as well. As I said before, there are books to be bought and signed at the back there if you want. It just remains for me to ask you to thank Stephen Sullivan, Paul John Dykes and Stephen Murray for an absolutely fascinating night of Celtic information and history. Enjoy part B of the Celtic History Night, which was recorded at the Admiral Bar about 2 weeks ago with the excellent authors and the chat that was involved. And I must thank St Anthony for preparing that audio recording for us. There will be more podcasts along soon. As I said at the beginning, don't forget we have the Celtic FC Foundation Bucket Collection for the Christmas Appeal this Saturday at the Hamilton game. So get your change ready if you're wanting to participate in any way, shape or form. Contact Celtic FC Foundation, go on the website and you'll be able to find it. Anyway, enough of me. Winter's here, Christmas is coming, and Celtic are going to win the league and a couple of cups. God bless. Good night.